jump-starting the imagination today, beginning with a Russian-American trickster of a writer, Gary Steingart. He's famous for his wickedly sardonic novels, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, Super Sad True Love Story. Steingart has had the kind of literary success a lot of writers would kill for. Even his book trailers go viral, which could have something to do with the fact that James Franco stars in them. So it doesn't seem quite fair that he's titled his new memoir, Little Failure.
Little Failure was a cute nickname that my mom had for me when I was growing up. When I graduated from Oberlin College in Ohio, they expected me, after $100,000 in tuition, to become a lawyer or something like that. And I came out to them and said, look, I want to be a writer. And one day my mother was visiting my 100-square-foot apartment on the Lower East Side, which back then Manhattan wasn't fully gentrified completely. And I was living in this tiny place with sloping floors and a water bug so big he looked like he could have been my roommate. And she looked around and said, my God, you're such a failure-chka, which is in the diminutive word of failure. The English word failure, but chka makes it little. So that was my moniker, and it kind of stuck, you know.
Well, the chka makes it sound little and sort of sweet. I mean, does that make it sort of affectionate?
Yeah, she was affectionately saying that I was a little failure.
So this seems kind of characteristic of your family, the barbed joke, the hostility disguised as affection, or vice versa.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. Do you think it's a Russian thing or a family tradition or both?
Well, it could be a Russian thing, although since the book came out, I've been touring a lot, and people from all kinds of different ethnicities have been coming up and saying, yeah, I'm getting that too. That kind of barbed humor, and also the constant put-downs. And the constant put-downs are supposed to make sure that the child, even if the child is, let's say, 37 years old, still goes on to medical school or dental school or law school and fulfills the parents' ambitions, because the parents had to give up everything to come to this country. And so the child feels it upon themselves to continue that tradition. One reader in New York came up to have her book signed, and she said, can you sign it to, quote, a little failure's failed paralegal? And I almost cried. I thought, you poor woman, you're not a failure. You can do whatever you want.
Well, so it sounds like you grew up in a family in which there was almost always a subtext or a double meaning.
Yes, and that is great for a writer. The jokes they tell, the satire they use, the stuff that you mentioned, you know, is hostility masquerading as affection or affection masquerading as hostility, all that kind of stuff is wonderful for a writer. I encourage all writers to be called little failure by their parents, all budding writers, because it really focuses your mind on language and the way language is used. And even if it's not used in a way that soothes you, it will be material at some point.
Mm. Now, well, that was why I asked, because I think that although that sounds like a damaging, somewhat, environment, it probably was really great training for a writer. So how do you think that shaped your particular voice and your interests as a writer?
Well, before my memoir, the three books I've written have been satires. And I think that growing up with parents from the Soviet Union, growing up partly in the Soviet Union, telling Brezhnev jokes, you know, was just how people bonded, making fun of the government, making fun of the ridiculous system. So I think I always grew up with a very kind of jaundiced eye, just looking at things very skeptically. That's not a great way to be as a person, but it's a great way to be as a writer. Most writers I know are probably not going to win Happiest Woman or Happiest Man of the Year awards. They just aren't that happy. And especially the funny writers, I notice. The funnier you are, the more I think there's a tragic undercurrent.
Now, why do you think that is?
Because I think humor is one of the highest forms of tragedy there is. People talk about the serious novel in these sort of hallowed tones and how important it is. But I think a lot of the humorous stuff, books by writers like Sam Lipsyte and even writers like Mordecai Richler in Canada, who's no longer with us, these are some of the most funny and tragic books I know, because humor doesn't work unless you're making fun of something that keeps paper cutting you throughout your life, something that keeps hurting and hurting you. And that's why parents and relationships and the political system are such delicious targets.
The really depressing thing, which is both depressing, painful, and funny, the way you tell it, is there was this comment your father made to you, and it sounded like not that long ago, when he said, I think by then you were a successful writer, and he said something like, yeah, well, a friend of mine told me nobody will ever remember your books.
Now, the actual quote was, "I read on the Russian internet that soon you and your novels will be forgotten," which I loved so much that I remember taking out my phone and just typing it down. It just sounded so awesome and so almost Old Testament. Soon you and your novel will be forgotten.
And there's so much buried in that. I read on the Russian internet.
I read on the Russian internet. So some Masha from Minsk said, you know, whatever. It never really ends. You can be a big success, but if Misha from Murmansk says you're a schmuck, then you're a schmuck.
I thought I heard overtones of kind of Soviet hatred of the capitalist pig Americans in there, too. You know, so the Russian internet says, soon, you capitalist writer, your works will be forgotten.
One of the headlines, not the headlines, but one of the reviews of one of my books in Russian was, "Balding traitor betrays motherland." So there's a fine tradition of that. But I remember watching a documentary where Woody Allen goes back to his parents and his mother, and they say, "Well, how do you feel about all your son's successes?" And the mother said, "I still think he should have been a pharmacist."
You know? Right.
So it never ends.
Yeah. So I want to go back to your very beginnings as a writer. You have a wonderful memory of writing your first, admittedly very short, novel at the tender age of 5, I think. Yeah. What was it?
Yeah, Lenin and His Magical Goose. My grandmother was a journalist for Evening Leningrad, a newspaper in Leningrad, and she said, "Can you write a small novel for me, and I'll pay you a slice of cheese for each page you write?" And I loved the Soviet cheese. I was very excited. So I wrote 100 pages for 100 slices of cheese, and it was called Lenin and His Magical Goose, and I loved Lenin. There was a huge statue. The biggest statue of Lenin in all of Leningrad was right outside of our building. And so I wrote a novel in which Lenin meets a magical goose from a southern clime, Armenia or Georgia, let's say, and they invade Finland and they create a socialist revolution in Finland. They make Finland safe for socialism, but then a fight breaks out between Lenin and the goose, and Lenin eats the goose because the goose is Menshevik and Lenin is Bolshevik. So, so a 5-year-old kid, but, you know, in Russia, a 5-year-old could be a pretty well-educated kid.
Yeah, but that's such a dark and depressing story. I mean, already with the betrayal.
Already with the betrayal, already political arguments are breaking out, geese are being eaten. But it's tragicomic when you think about it.
Yeah. Well, so then there's another kind of key moment in your development as a writer. It's some years later, you've emigrated to the U.S. where you are, of course, one of those deeply unpopular, picked-on kids at school. What didn't they like about you?
You got to remember, this is 1980, and it's the evil empire era, Reagan's evil empire speech, and the movies are out there, the Red Dawn, Red Hamster, whatever, you know, it's just, it never ends. So the kids are pushing me into the wall and screaming Rusky and Commie and all that. I'm pretending I was born in East Berlin instead of being born in Leningrad. I'm in a Hebrew school. I'm trying to get Jewish kids to think I'm a German because that's better than being a Russian, you know. And at the same time, I start writing these little science fiction books because I love science fiction. And there's a very nice teacher who lets me read them at the end of each English period. And then I write the Genora, which is a satire in the Torah, you know, where Exodus becomes Sexodus and all this kind of stuff. And so the point is that I make my first friends. Through writing, I make my first friends. Earlier, because of my writing, my grandmother gave me cheese and loved me. And Random House still pays me in cheese. The tradition continues, you know. And now these kids like me because I write. So somewhere inside my psyche is the idea is born that the only way I can get people to really like me is by constantly writing. Or if I stop writing, I'm the red hamster again.
There's a really funny passage that I wondered if you would read for us.
Okay.
It's the passage about your family receiving a letter from the publisher's clearinghouse.
Okay.
Maybe you could just set it up for us.
This is about 2 years after we leave Russia, and we are not wealthy. In 1981, an official letter arrives in our mailbox. "Mr. S. Weingart, you have already won $10 million. Sure, our last name is misspelled rather cruelly, but cardstock this thick does not lie. And the letter is from a major American publisher, to wit, the Publisher's Clearing House. I open the letter with shaking hands, and a check falls out. Pay to the order of S. Weingart, $10 million and $100. Our lives are about to change. I run down the stairs into the courtyard of our apartment complex. Mama, Papa, we won, we won. We are millionaires. Calm down, my father says. Do you want an asthma attack? But he's nervous and excited himself. Around the glowing surface of the orange dining table imported from Romania, we spread around the contents of the voluminous packet. For 2 years, we have been good news citizens, while accidentally watching X-rated movies on Main Street, getting jobs as engineers and clerk typists, learning to pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and for the something for which that it stands, unavoidable with money for all. Bonjour, moi, my mother says, my God, as we look at the pictures on the envelope of a Mercedes flying off the deck of our yacht toward our new mansion with its Olympic-sized swimming pool. Oi, does it have to be a Mercedes? Pooh, they're Nazis. Don't worry, we can trade it for a Cadillac. Bonjour, moi, how many bedrooms does this house have? 7, 8, 9. You can forget about the yacht, Gary, it's dangerous. But I know how to swim, Mama. How do you keep the pool open in the winter? Snow will get in. Look, there's palm trees. Maybe it's in Florida. Florida won't be good for your asthma with all that humidity. I want to live in Miami. Maybe there aren't Hebrew schools in Miami. Everywhere in America, there are Hebrew schools. That night in my dreams, I walk into the Solomon Schechter School of Queens, a multi-millionaire. And the pretty girl with the big teeth, who's always tanned from her Florida vacation, kisses me with those big teeth. I haven't gotten the mechanics of kissing down yet. The kids make fun of Jonah Himmelstein, the school's biggest loser, but I say, hey, he's my friend now. Here is $2. Buy us both the Carvel Flying Saucer cookie ice cream and keep the change, you garnished, you nothing.
Oh, it's hilarious and it's heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah.
Or I don't know, is that a good memory?
Yeah, that's one of the better ones.
You write a lot about the past, and the past, and your family's past in the Soviet Union overshadows everything. You wound up going back with your parents to the Soviet Union in 2011. Was that a pivotal trip? Did it put anything to rest?
It did. It did. You know, you grow up with tough immigrant parents, and in your 20s, earlier than that, maybe even a little bit later than that, they want you so much to be who they want you to be, you develop a huge sense of anger toward them, rage sometimes. And I think going back with them and seeing the difficulties of how they grew up, of how much apart Stalin and Hitler were of their earliest years. They were born to a bombed out country. My father's first memory is diving under a train as the Germans strafed the train and they were being evacuated from Leningrad. After a while, you hear these stories and you see them walk through the places where all these things happened. And the feelings of rage become feelings of sorrow and sadness and a kind of sorrow that they didn't grow up in a better country under better circumstances, that they didn't have a chance to pursue the dreams that they wanted to pursue. My father wanted very much to be an opera singer. And I think in a normal country, his beautiful voice maybe would have had a chance, but certainly not there.
Gary Steingart's new memoir is called Little Failure. And if you haven't seen it yet, don't miss the book trailer, which features James Franco as Gary's pink bathrobe-wearing husband and Jonathan Franzen as his hostile therapist. We'll post it on our website, ttbook.org.